I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening, thank you for being there. Thank you for being part of this wonderful adventure, this journey, which we've been on now for 4 years.
4 years.
And I'm incredibly impressed with it. I didn't even know what a podcast was when we started.
We should have some kind of party after five.
We could do. But on the other hand, we could just keep doing the podcast.
Yeah, you know, I like an excuse for a party.
Yeah. Oh, I like any excuse for a party too, no question about that. But let's put it this way. We'll have a party with all of you in electronic space, in out there, in listener land.
Yeah. Take this as the party.
Take this as a party.
Wherever you're listening.
Yeah. Whether it's in Britain, America, Australia, South Africa, we've got listeners in all sorts of places.
All over the world.
Yes, very exciting.
I think we have a few in sort of Scandinavia zones, Finland maybe.
Okay, well.
I think. I don't know, I haven't looked at our stats for a long time.
Well, we probably should, if only to so we know what we're talking about.
Check the stats.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should, good idea.
And also, it gives us an opportunity to look back at things and cases and events that perhaps have slipped out of the memory. You know, that some things stay in the mind and some things don't.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so in some cases, for example, just resonate every time the word or the man or the woman or whatever is mentioned.
Mm.
And others just fade. And it's
very weird.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is odd that something sticks.
Well, one of the reasons that I thought I chose to do this particular case today is because I think an awful lot of people had forgotten it. In fact, it's a very famous case. We have very few mass shootings in this country. Unlike America, we have comparatively few. And one of the ones that people remember is a man called Raoul Moat.
Yeah, we've done him, haven't we?
Oh, we have, yeah. But Raoul Moat, people...
Usually the one that hid in the bunker thing.
Yeah, well, it was sort of sewage pipe.
In the woods.
Pipe. Sewage
yeah.
pipe, yeah. And the man who was tasered too often. And that's the...
Yeah, I remember.
But that story remains in people's minds, whereas this one somehow doesn't. And yet this was one of the most extraordinary cases. All took place in one day in 2010.
Just before you tell us that, I was listening to an audiobook the other day, and I didn't know this, but in American schools, you do drills for if somebody comes and, like, opens fire in your school.
Yeah.
That is nuts.
Frightening.
That you have to train children to hide from a gun person in a school.
Well, you get yourself into the whole gun control argument there. I mean, I'm not saying you're not right, you are. It is extraordinary.
I just can't believe that you have to teach, like you do your fire drill and then you do your gun drill.
Yes.
Like this is what we do if someone breaks into the school and tries to shoot everyone.
Yes.
I just think that's so shocking.
It is shocking.
It's a school.
Yes.
I know that they happen there and they're so awful, but I just...
But the point I'm making, by way of response, is you have to take that up with the National Rifle Association, who still believe it's the right of every American to bear arms, and has convinced numerous presidents that should remain the case.
Why?
Yes.
Well,
you could equally argue, and just to be sort of a tiny bit controversial, you could equally say, well, isn't that a good thing that we should take the precaution of teaching young people?
I absolutely agree. Yes, no, I do. We should teach them that because, you know, it's like if you live in Japan, you do earthquake drills or whatever.
Yes.
Like, you know, I get it.
Yeah.
But it's just really sad.
It is very sad. I agree with you.
Not a natural disaster, is it? Fire, earthquake.
Yes.
You know, well, tsunami.
Yes. Well, one bizarre gunman.
But, and then gun drills.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Well,
let's hear about the rarity of a British...
Well, the most famous of... Just to finish up this point, and I'll come back to what the case...
Right.
The most famous of the British school shootings was, of course, not in Scotland, in Dunblane, in 1996.
Yeah.
With 18 people died.
Yeah, I know. How many school shootings have there been in the UK?
Not very many. The school shooting that everyone remembers is Dunblane. One of the things that prompted me to go back to this case was the shooting in Plymouth, in the southwest of England.
That happened not long ago.
That was a supermarket shooting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And one particular shooting spree in Hungerford in 1987 ended in a school, but that was more by chance.
Mm.
That was the school that the gunman attended. But this shooting, or series of shootings, is remarkably often overlooked. It took place in Cumbria on the 2nd of June 2010.
I remember this one.
Mm.
What are we calling this? Are we starting?
I think we should call it the Cumbrian shootings.
The Cumbrian shootings.
Okay. On that particular day, the 2nd of June 2010, Derek Bird, who was 52 years old, killed 12 people and injured 11 others before finally killing himself. That's a lot of people. A lot.
Mm.
And he was a taxi driver. A bit of a loner, but, you know, affable enough. And he did it carrying a 12-gauge double-barreled shotgun and a 22-caliber bolt-action rifle with a scope and a silencer. Now, this is a taxi driver on the rank in Whitehaven in Cumbria. A small town, quite beautiful, gets lots of visitors. So let's deal with the spree first and then come back to why. Because that's the classic question, isn't it? What on earth possesses a man in his 50s, 52, to kill so many people, to injure so many others, and to effectively reduce that part of West Cumbria to a quivering jelly? I mean, people were terrified. And why? What was the reason for this? So let's recount the events first. That's, in a way, that's easier. And then we can come back to why on earth this happened. Bird was born on the 27th of November 1957. He had a twin brother called David, and her parents were called Mary and Joe. He went to a local school and he married set up home with one of the girls who was at school with him, called Linda Mills, and they had two children, Graham and Jamie. So far, so normal, you would have said. He has a bit of a checkered history. He worked at the Sellafield nuclear plant, which is very near to Whitehaven in Cumbria. But in 1990, he was fired for theft and got a 6-month suspended sentence for stealing decorating equipment. I mean, it takes your breath away, really.
Why did they press charges against him for that?
He went on to become self-employed taxi driver, working in Cumbria. He meets another woman, Judith, in Workington in the 94 and the couple are together for 6 years or so. But they never lived together. Bird was in many ways an archetypal loner. In October 98, his father died. He'd worked on the roads for the council. You know, good, upright, mm-hmm. working man. And he who apparently gave all his sons, because there was another brother as well as the twins, David and Derek, an interest in guns. In fact, Derek Bird had had a shotgun license since 1974, renewed on a regular basis. Same police checks, had to be kept in a locked cabinet, all of the above. Judith's, his girlfriend's sister, got cancer in 1999, and she claimed that Derek was, and I quote, emotionally void and not giving her any support. Sadly, her sister died in 2000, and Judith ended things with Derek. Derek's working as a cab driver, you know, making a steady living, especially during the summer when there are lots of visitors. And then in March 2007, he applies for a firearms license, not for a shotgun license. This is one is a 22 rifle and a silencer.
Well, why would you need one of those?
Good question. I think he would probably have said it was for shooting rabbits. Can't shoot a rabbit with a shotgun, really.
Right, okay, understood. Well, what do you shoot with a shotgun?
Birds.
Oh, right, so for, like, clay pigeon shooting and stuff. And, like, shooting, like, pheasant shooting.
Things. Yeah.
And then you need something more...
really targeted.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was authorised to purchase 500 rounds of ammunition in any one transaction and could hold 1,500 rounds at any one time.
What for?
Why would you need 1,500 rounds?
You can't shoot 1,500 rabbits.
No, you can't. But at the same time as all this is going on, Bird gets into a row with four of his passengers in his taxi on the 7th of October 2007. And he's beaten up. He has broken dentures, of chipped front tooth, bruised right shoulder, admitted to hospital overnight. And one of the passengers, a 19-year-old, admitted causing actual bodily harm and was charged and convicted. After that, Bird became what he described as nervous and anxious, and he stopped working at night. He's not popular with his fellow Whitehaven taxi drivers. He's always accusing them of stealing his fares and slashing his tyres, and, you know, he's got a thing. And he's all pent up, he's on his own, Judith is gone, he's a strange, almost Dickensian figure, hiding away. And he's also a hypochondriac, there's no question about that. He's always going to A&E with a pain in his neck, and he's got a bad and lost my sense of smell. And he's got all kinds of... Then he reports himself feeling really down.
Well, he probably had depression by the sounds of it.
Sounds like
he probably could have done with some help.
I think that's right, but he didn't get any.
No, and then look what happened.
Yes. Anyway, this whole unhappiness and the assault and everything else just clearly got the better of him. And so in the early hours of the 2nd of June 2010, he leaves his home, which is a tiny village called Rora in Cumbria, and drives his Citroen Picasso to his twin brother David's house in Lamplugh nearby. He kills him. He shoots him. 11 times in the head and torso with his 22 rifle.
11 times?
11 times.
That's really messed up.
Well, it seems excessive, doesn't it? He then gets back into his car and drives to the home of the family solicitor. He and his brother's family solicitor, a man called Kevin Commons. Commons is I should say that David, of course, is 52, just like Derek. And Commons is a man of 60, who lives in a house in not far away. The house is in Frizzington in West Cumbria. On CCTV footage, Bird is seen driving down the single access road to the farmhouse in Yeat House Road in Frizzington. And he's seen lurking about for about 5 hours. This is 5:14, I think, is first caught on CCTV. 10:13, there are reports of shots fired. Commons leaves his house and discovers that Citroen Picasso is blocking the way out, the access road to his house. He then encounters Bird, who proceeds to shoot him. First of all with the shotgun, and then with him on the road outside his house. This time the police are called. I mean, no one's found his brother yet. Now comes what is sometimes called the second phase to the killings in Cumbria. Clearly now, possessed by some demons that only he knows the reality of, he goes to the Whitehaven taxi rank, where he proceeds to shoot a man he perceives as his born enemy, the man he thinks slashed his tyres, a man called Darren Rucastle. He's shot in point-blank range.
Jesus.
It later emerges at an inquest that Bird had said at some point, not that long earlier, not that much before, the Whitehaven rank were winding him up and they were going to get it big time in the near future. Well, like that as well. Another taxi driver shot in the face. Another taxi driver is shot and tries to protect himself and puts his hand up. He has to have his hand amputated.
Jesus.
Bird starts driving round Whitehaven with the shotgun pointing out of the passenger side window. Bird's taxi driving in one direction, another taxi driver's driving in the other direction. They know each other, they recognise each other. Bird stops, the other taxi driver stops, he's got a passenger, a woman. Bird shoots them both. Out of the blue, bang.
God, that's so awful.
About 11 o'clock that morning, there's now, by of course, now, the police have launched a full-scale manhunt for the Bird. There are chases. Then at 11 o'clock that morning, his twin brother David's body is found. Between 11 and 11:35... quite at random, Bird shoots a man called Kenneth Fishburne, who's 71, who worked at Sellafield, though there was no connection between the two and they didn't necessarily know each other. I'm not suggesting he went on a hunt for Sellafield workers. I'm not suggesting that for a moment. And then a woman called Susan Hughes, who's 57, is shot in the head and chest and killed as she walks home from the town with her shopping. It's extraordinary. He goes to the house of a woman he knows. They serve on a diving club committee together. But he doesn't kill her. But at the bottom of the drive to their house, he kills a retired couple, Jennifer and James Jackson, using, again, this combination of both the shotgun and the rifle. And at 11:27 that morning of the 2nd of June 2010, the last two victims are shot within seconds of each other on the same street in Seascale. Retired Michael Pike, who's 64, is killed while riding his bike. And further up the road, Jane Robinson, 66, is out delivering home shopping catalogues, and she's shot at point-blank range. I mean, it is a tragedy. Anyway, the killer heads for what's known as the Eskdale Valley where he opens fire on six more random targets, injuring another three people. He's now injured 11 people and killed 12. It's a particularly sad moment. He pulls up beside one tourist called Samantha and asks if she's having a nice day before he shoots her in the face. She said later, and she's a 30-year-old teacher from Kent, "I thought to myself, lie still. He'll think I'm dead and won't come back and shoot me." He drives, Bird drives to a beauty spot near Boot in Cumbria, in West Cumbria, called Doctor Bridge, where finally the police issue a photograph of Bird and identify him as the shooter. Armed police are pursuing him at this point. The last time he's seen is at 12:31 on that morning of the 2nd of June. They find his car because by accident, Bird has effectively flattened the front tyre of the taxi. He's crashed into a wall and the tyre's gone down. The taxi's in bits. And so he gets out of the taxi and is now on foot in this beauty spot. As a precaution, the local Sellafield nuclear plant is closed down. They shut the doors just in case. Because some people are saying, well, that must be his objective. He's going to go to Sellafield because he felt upset by they're sacking him. He disappears into a woods called Oak House Woods. Oak How Woods. At about 12:36, a whole slew of armed police arrive at the woods near this bridge. Bird by this time had loosed off 47 rounds of ammunition, 29 from the shotgun, 18 from the 22. And then, of course, turns the gun upon himself and kills himself in the woods. Now, this has all taken place within 12 hours. It's an absolute psychotic break. There can be no doubt about that. On the surface, Bird is perfectly normal. He's not the man who's been sitting there dressing up in camouflage fatigues and going to... But he has nevertheless had a shotgun licence for a very long time and a rifle licence for quite a long time, for 3 years. He's got the authority to have countless rounds of ammunition. And you ask yourself, why? Why? But then, to defend whoever the licensing authority was, presumably the local police, they saw no reason that he would pose any threat to them. At one point in this perambulation around West Cumbria, he goes to the house of a friend who he's lent a gun to, and his friend's not there, and the wife opens the door, and she doesn't have a key to the cupboard, so he doesn't kill her, he just doesn't collect the gun, another gun. He wanted to have another gun, but he doesn't get it.
Doesn't need any more guns.
No. So, that is the great spree, the shooting spree, the Cumbrian shootings. But why? Why would a 52-year-old man with no particular record of violence decide to shoot and kill 12 people and injure another 11? Well, I think there are at least four very interesting reasons, and that's what I thought would be worth going back over the case for. Now, one reason suggested by some locals is that he was very angry with being sacked from Sellafield in 1990. He was given a 12-month suspended sentence for theft. And it's fair to say, three of the dead were Sellafield employees. But there is absolutely no reason and no connection with any of them. I don't think he even knew them.
If that was the case, and it was because of Sellafield, and considering he, like, specifically went to his brother, his solicitor, and, you know, other specific people, it seems a bit odd. And then to the taxi firm, it seems weird to me that he wouldn't have just gone straight there.
Yeah.
Like, because it was too specific what he chose to do.
I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. I would discount Sellafield as any kind of... Got a lot of people in that area. It's one of the biggest employers. Of course, lots of people are going to work at Sellafield.
Yeah.
Okay, the second reason, given by some, is that... a Thai girl with whom he had become involved and who had returned to Thailand had asked him for £1,000, which he had duly sent, and then she dumped him by text message.
That one's possible.
Possible, but seems a bit...
Yeah, but it could be a trigger. Could be the trigger of just like, what's the point? Life's so crap. Blah, blah, blah.
Okay. The third... reason is a dispute with his brother over their father's will. Bad feeling, so to speak.
I mean, it did seem to me that there must be something to do with wills and family, because why would you shoot the solicitor as well as your brother?
I agree.
And then after that, you're like, well, I've shot them, so I might as well just
go on.
Go on.
Yeah. And I think the most compelling reason is probably the final one. Bird was the subject of a tax investigation by HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. He was said to have squirreled away £60,000 in a secret bank account. He also thought that his brother, his twin brother David, and the solicitor were going to help the HMRC's investigation and get him sent to prison for tax evasion.
He done put all his cash earnings in the bank without declaring them.
Well,
and that's what every taxi driver does.
Some of his earnings went in that were not declared, and some of them were, obviously.
Mm.
In the 3 days before the killing spree, Bird phoned his brother, twin brother, 44 times. There's clearly, in my mind, that is the obvious trigger, that he believes that his brother David and the solicitor, Kevin Commons, are somehow conspiring against him. And it just plays to the paranoia that's evidenced in the taxi driver incidents and in all the rest. You know, everybody's got it in for me.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to take my revenge. I'm not going to stand for it. I'm not staying still for this. And in a way, you can sort of, in a strange way, see his weird rationalization about why this should happen. But nevertheless, it's an incredible leap, isn't it, from killing your twin brother and your solicitor over an argument about tax evasion to killing another 10 people and then yourself. I mean, it's extraordinary. Yes, paranoia is one thing, but this is a paranoid delusion, isn't it? You know, you think everyone's against you. You go to the taxi rank and you shoot the man you think has slashed your tyres, and then you shoot another man, and then you shoot another man, and then you shoot another man, and then you don't mind. It doesn't matter. You shoot women, men, old women, younger women.
Yeah. I mean, I think it just, yeah, as you said, it just went, didn't it?
Spiraled. Just gone. It's gone. But it's an interesting case because... people are capable of the most extraordinary things.
That's true.
And I suppose you could say extraordinary evil, because it was clearly the act of a man deranged. And people were unfortunate enough to come across him on that particular morning. They hadn't done anything to him or even didn't even know him.
That is sad.
It is. And you can have the conventional arguments about gun control and, you know, why was he given that license and... did he need that much ammunition? But you could also argue that even if he hadn't given him the license, he still had the shotgun.
Yeah.
And he'd had that license since 1974.
Yeah.
So, and he hadn't committed any gun crime.
No, I don't think there's any way anyone would have known that that's what he was going to do.
No, I agree with that. And I think one of the things that we talk about a lot is that these crimes like these, they're not, if they were predictable, they wouldn't be happening. They're often unpredictable.
Exactly.
And, but
why you train the kids to hide from gunmen.
Yes. But you don't train an elderly lady taking her shopping home for the
village. It doesn't happen as much in the UK, does it? It's not.
No.
That is just completely random. Unfortunate. And I don't think that you can't try and justify those things. If you know what I mean.
I completely agree with you, Mo. You can't justify them.
Or say like, oh, you should have known it would happen, or be prepared, or I don't know. You can't be prepared for stuff like that.
No.
So.
But out of the blue, in one of the most beautiful bits of Britain.
I know, a very beautiful.
Very beautiful area. Well, you got Betsy from that neck of the woods, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Oxenholme.
Okay. Yeah, so Cumbrian.
She is a Lake District dog.
She's a Lake District girl.
Sleeping.
Not very wise, I'd have thought. Encourage her mistress to sleep a bit more, I think.
Yeah, well, that was really interesting.
I think it is an interesting case, yes. And I'm pleased to have done it, actually.
The Cumbrian shootings.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Mo. Well, what's on the horizon? Have you going on? No, you've been on holiday. Sorry, I've got to get it right.
I know. It's confusing because we're having to record things at different times because you're so busy. Busy man.
Well,
have you watched anything on TV you like recently, or have you not had time?
I haven't had a lot of time, to be honest. I'm finishing up Better Call Saul.
Oh, right, yeah. I've not watched that.
Which I like a lot. And they're filming the UK version of Call My Agent in the gardens behind my flat tomorrow.
No.
Yep.
That's so funny.
It's only one scene, I think.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I watched this thing called The White Lotus that a lot of people have been talking about.
No, I haven't heard of that. What's that?
It's on Sky. That's why you haven't been able to see it. It's a kind of...
Where did you see it then?
I watched it on Now. I've got... I don't have a Now account, but I'm on someone else's.
Oh, well, good.
It's a sort of character study of this... someone told this showrunner called Mike White to come up with an idea that's all shot in one place. And he did it in a kind of very smart holiday resort in Hawaii. And it's the sort of character study of the posh people that go and the people that work there.
Okay.
It is literally just like quite a detailed character study. It's very clever. And also kind of exploration into kind of the difference between the privileged and...
The underprivileged.
The underprivileged.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very good. And then I watched something on Amazon called 9 Perfect Strangers, which is this Nicole Kidman thing, which is not dissimilar concept.
I haven't looked at that yet. I was planning to.
Yeah, it's good. I liked it. It's got a good cast.
Yeah, it's got a good cast.
Similar concept. It's like 10 very wealthy people go to Nicole Kidman's
spa retreat thing
to kind of, yeah. And it's about what goes on there. And all of their issues.
Well.
I'd recommend.
What else would I recommend? I don't know. There seem to be so much to look at.
Yeah.
I'm sometimes shaking my head.
My client Jason Wong is in Silent Witness.
Okay.
He's not in the episodes. Well, he will be by the time this comes out.
Okay. What's his name?
Jason Wong.
Oh, yes, Jason Wong, yes.
Yeah. What else? Professor T got picked up for a second series.
Great. Two of your clients?
Two of my clients.
Excellent.
My client just got a really good job in something, but I can't tell you about it on here.
Okay.
Because it's
confidential. No worries.
So yeah, you know.
Well, I'm when this goes out, I should be tramping around the country.
Who knows where you'll be? I don't have my big schedule.
I've got it with me at this instant. Mm.
But yeah, so lots going on.
Yep.
As ever.
Well, let's hope so. Keep it up. Well, thank you, Mo. That's great.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, my brother, Dan, who did the music, my friend, George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners, thank you very much.
Yes, I heartily agree with that. Just as I always thank Molly, I always thank you most of all for bearing with us, for being so communicative. I get lots of messages and we're all very, always touched to get them.
So nice, our listeners.
Very, very, very,
very
touching.
Nice people.
Very nice people.
I've ordered a blanket from Natalie in the crochet group for my friend's baby. She's crocheting for me.
Good for you.
Pretty excited about it.
Very good.
Yeah.
We have Natalie. Crochet supporters, don't we, on Instagram?
We do, because of Natalie. She's the one.
Okay.
She's the one. And then we got loads more crochet fans because of her. So thank you. I hope you're enjoying your crochet.
I hope you're enjoying your crocheting. Thank you, Mo. And as I often say at the end of these, to all the wonderful listeners that we have, do be careful out there.